Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Port Townsend resident Curtis White. He was born in 1951 in San Lorenzo, California, and went to public schools through high school, then to the University of San Francisco. His life and work were deeply influenced by the counterculture of the 1960s, by the anti-war movement, and by the psychedelic art and music scene in San Francisco in the late 60s. In 1973, he went to the writing seminars at the Johns Hopkins University, where he was coached in fiction writing by the novelist John Barth. In 1975, he went to the University of Iowa for a PhD and studied with Gayatri Spivak, the leading American expert on the philosophy of Jacques Derrida. Barth and Spivak provided the two poles for his work for the remainder of his career, first as a novelist, then later as a culture critic. Over a 40-year career, he has published 13 books and hundreds of stories, essays, and reviews. Among his novels are The Idea of Home, Memories of My Father Watching TV, and Requiem, all currently in print with Dalkey Archive Press. Notable among his works of cultural criticism are The Middle Mind from HarperCollins, The Spirit of Disobedience, and The Science Delusion. His most recent book, We Robots, Staying Human in the Age of Big Data, was published in 2016 by Melville House Press. He was also published frequently in Harper's Magazine, Orion, The Village Voice, Tricycle, Playboy, and Laugham's Quarterly. His first novel in 15 years will appear in 2018 with Melville House. Welcome, Curtis.
Thank you. Good to be here. Good to be living in Port Townsend.
I was just going to say, I'm glad you're living here in Port Townsend after your career in Illinois. You somehow went from the West Coast to the Midwest.
It's called Follow the Employment Opportunities.
Right. And from there, you wrote quite a lot of books while you were in Illinois.
I was able to be very productive there. It was a very good place for me to be. I was left alone, basically, to do what I wanted.
Well, that was a good find then for
you. Yes, indeed.
Yes.
So everyone should be so fortunate.
I'll cross my fingers, too. I'm going to start by asking you a question that a lot of people have asked me when I said we'll be talking today, and that is, what is a culture critic?
Well, I can only tell you what a culture critic is for me. I don't think there is a thing called a culture critic that we can give a firm definition to. But for me, a culture critic had two qualities that are fairly ordinary. One is a ruthless honesty, to borrow Karl Marx's adjective, ruthless, the ruthless critique of everything existing, as he said. That's an important quality in a culture that seems much more interested in self-interested stories than it does in honesty. The second quality is a little less important or acknowledged within the culture is the importance of having a kind of knowledge context. It's one of the reasons that at one time the absence of so-called popular intellectuals, public intellectuals, was so much lamented, because that tradition of the public intellectual brought people with a very broad kind of knowledge of history, generally speaking, the history of ideas in particular, but also a very usable familiarity with science and with the arts. And I worked very hard to provide that kind of context. It's not that I'm an expert in science matters or an expert in music matters, but I have a usable familiarity with their histories that makes it possible for me to place my criticisms in that context. But the thing that most defines, it seems to me, and this may seem more unique to myself or to my way of defining the culture critic, that the culture critic needs to be a storyteller. Most of the things that we're reacting against are narrative in one way or another. So it's stories that we're told that sort of seek a certain kind of authority and have a certain kind of authority, whether it's from the Christian right or from Democrats or Republicans or whoever it might be. They are storytellers, it seems to me, first and foremost. And so it's important for people who find those stories oppressive in one way or another to be capable of counter stories. And so I think of myself as a counter storyteller. That's my form of cultural criticism. I thought that I might read something briefly here that is from a work that I'm in the middle of right now that will give you a better idea of exactly what I mean by cultural criticism as a form of storytelling. This is from an essay whose general title is A Democracy Beyond Democracy. And it's quite long, but this is just the first part of it from a section called the three fateful, not fatal, but fateful, ironies of democracy. We often hear it reported that in some benighted countries, the people believe that, quote, democracy is a nice idea, but it's not for us. We need a strong guiding hand. So convinced of this are these people that, given the opportunity, they will in fact vote for this strong hand and all that comes with it, making democracy an oxymoron. We tend to think that these foreign skeptics just don't get it, and so some of us think that we ought to help them to understand. As Representative Darren LaHood, Republican of Illinois, said during a recent high school visit, the goal of our foreign policies is to make the world more like us. A default neocon, LaHood wants to bring democracy to the heathens, an even worse idea than trying to convert them to Christianity. The appeal to democracy coming from the lips of politicians like LaHood is a paternalistic fraud at the best. At the worst, it is no more than what it was in the colonial Middle East after World War I, the preparation for a great looting. As President Trump likes to say, take the oil. The recent presidential election has shown that the U.S. may itself be one of these benighted countries, especially since we have decided that we need a president who will stand up to foreign hostiles like Australia and domestic enemies like newspaper reporters and comedians. As David Gergen said of Donald Trump, there is this extra dimension working in Trump's favor. Americans are looking beyond particular policy for the personality that looks like somebody strong enough, tough enough, big enough to provide security. This is worse than an oxymoron. It is a tale told by an idiot. What politicians like LaHood are incapable of contemplating is the idea that democracy is fractured by fateful ironies that tend toward its own failure. The first of these ironies is the idea that democracy is the expression of a we, the demos, the American people, as politicians like to say. If the American people that Barack Obama refers to are the same American people that Ted Cruz refers to, then the American people have a personality disorder. Among the conspicuous realities of social life in the United States, this reality should be the most conspicuous. We are not one and never have been. There is no we. There are no Americans. Not only are we divided by those things that divide most regions of the world, tribe, sect, class, race, gender, we are also divided by something that feels unique to us, almost genetic. It is our founding psychopathology, first animated by the mutual dislike of Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. Historians refer to it as our first national crisis, the conflict between Republican and Federalist. And it more than once led Jefferson to contemplate secession for Virginia and like-minded states. The Republicans accused the Federalists of being elitists and monarchists. The Federalists called the Republicans busy and restless sons of anarchy, the anarchy consisting essentially of contempt for centralized lawmaking. Our version of this conflict expresses itself as urban liberalism versus the evangelism, guns, and hatred for all things federal that presently enlivens those gathered inside the Tea Party's sanctimonious tiny tent. If there is a word for a country permanently divided against itself, we should use it. Because the truth is that for the last 150 years, we have lived in a Cold War continuation of the Civil War.
Well, okay. Maybe later on in our conversation, you'll possibly pick up a little bit.
There is more there that I could read if you'd like.
Okay. You will let us know when that might fit in. Okay. All right. I'm eager to hear more, although it's very disconcerting and elevating at the same time.
One of the things I go on to discuss is the fact that this notion of a we is not just something that happens among ultra-conservatives and white supremacists and the people that we're opposed to, who always want to talk about real Americans, right? We real Americans. But the left is very much prone to this idea that there's a united us or a we that is going to correct the problems that it sees, which are many, obviously, within American politics and society. And I think that that's just as problematic. I sort of cringe intellectually when I hear someone argue that what we should be in the business of is creating a mass movement. Because the mass movement implies that there's this enormous we that is just waiting for us to organize it. But the truth is that usually one mass meets another mass. and then historically becomes a very dangerous situation.
I was just thinking of your words, a long Cold War here since the Civil War.
Right. I think we have to accept that those things are, as far as we humans are concerned in human time, those differences are permanent.
So what do we do? What do whatever we have to do?
Well, you know, that's sort of where I get to eventually in the essay is talking about there are a number of alternatives. There are a lot of alternatives. One is the situation as we have it now, which is we let an oligarchy and its military run the country. That's more or less what we have right now. The other possibility, which is related to that, may be that fascist or neo-fascist forces will align itself with that oligarchy and that military. That seems to me to be very much incomplete at this point, because I don't think the oligarchy necessarily has any particular interest in hanging out with white supremacists. That's a story that has yet to find its conclusion. The other possibilities are, of course, that we could return to what I take it Move On would like to return to, which is basically the neoliberal situation as defined by the Clinton and Obama administrations, which seems to me really undesirable because I was reading James Baldwin, as I guess everybody has been recently after the movie, and he was a telling phrase in The Fire Next Time about hundreds of thousands of people are harmed every day by people who don't know and don't want to know that they're the source of that harm. And I thought that that could be applied very easily, I think, to a sort of Clintonian neoliberalism. One of the things that we've learned in this election is that the people who are being harmed are letting us know. So there's that option. And then there's the more diluted, I think, socialist option, which is this idea that we're all going to rise up and have a mass movement that will eventually correct all these problems and we'll live in some sort of unified state
of
the left.
Can I just say that this is actually what Trump has promised, that there is no problem in America that cannot be solved. So it's very complicated.
It's very complicated. But in my experience, the thing that's worked is not to think in terms of national problem solving, but to think in terms of countercultures, creating autonomous life. There's a lot less danger of being deceived, betrayed, and disappointed when basically you're seeking control of the terms of your own life.
So how would that play out in a life, especially the lives of those who are being harmed? Any thoughts on that? Difficult.
Very difficult. The big part of the problem there is that the thing that stands in the way of countercultural thinking is anybody who's indulged in it, whether that means through art or through agriculture, you know, locavore, local farms, think local, all that stuff, which I completely support. The difficulty of it is money. And the problem with money is that we, quite apart from whatever political reality may exist, we live in a regime of money. We live under the reign of money. Our sociality is the sociality of money. So all relationships between people, as well as everything else, animals in the and the material world as well, is mediated by money. The biggest problem, and it's almost imponderable, but it's the problem that has to be faced, is what to do about that fact, the fact that we live in a sociality of money or the reign of money. Because that's what makes our desire for autonomy and the possibilities that countercultures, and when I say countercultures, I don't mean hippies. I don't mean the 1960s. What I mean is literally cultures that run counter to the dominant culture.
Right or left?
I think that's a very good point, because I do think that one of the things I go into, and maybe I'll just read a bit of it here, is the fact that if the divisions that we see within the country are permanent divisions, there's going to have to be a certain kind of latitude given to those others. Not so long ago, Texas was a national laughingstock because of its secession movement. But in the age of Trump, liberals also see the appeal of secession and sigh, "I'd volunteer for a civil war to take the South out of the Union." And in a sense, many blue states have already seceded through the process called voting with your feet, an unprecedented migration of intelligence and ambition to the West Coast and to places like Austin and Denver. Because of this, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in California over Trump by 4.5 million votes, 150% of her margin of victory in the national popular vote. So which fact is the more significant, the fact that California is one state among many, or the fact that it is the world's sixth largest economy, with 12% of the total U.S. population? It's not lost upon California itself. In 2019, the people of California will have the opportunity to vote Yes, California and Cal Exit stage left. With every passing legislative session, the state governments of the West Coast come closer to living in an economic and social reality that is separate, if not seceded, from the rest of the country. I also argue that since both the South and the North, both sort of poles of our culture as well, political poles of the culture, talk about wanting to live in a kind of a separate reality, there should be more tolerance for that.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with Port Townsend resident Curtis White about his writing as a culture critic and novelist.
Are people actually, besides just saying things about secession, are they planning? It sounds complicated to do.
Well, yeah, of course. Just think about the things that are going on here in Washington with legalizing marijuana. That's to say that state law, for the time being, is being allowed to be a federal scoff law.
Meaning
that we're seceded. We're not part of that legislative reality. We're creating our own legislative
reality. What's really interesting to me is at the same time that the current administration is talking about the states taking over so many things, they're also talking about enforcing federal law on the recreational marijuana stuff. So
that's bad. We don't like that.
Right, there's no tolerance then.
Right. Right. I totally agree. But also the idea of sanctuary cities. The idea that states and cities should have their own minimum wage laws. The idea that states and cities are going to create their own laws having to do with transgender rights. All of these things are creating alternative kind of social and political realities in particular regions. You could say it's a kind of a states' right issue, but really it's much more about a more radical dividing of cultures into separate spheres.
And then what's going to happen if we do have a building up and we're looking for tolerance or latitude, as you're saying, in the differences, yet we have a federal government that supplies some funds, that we have interconnections of highways, military bases.
I know.
We are both the United States of America and the untied states.
I'm just saying that this seems to me to be the direction that the country seems to be moving in is towards this, not only a kind of intellectual and ideological polarity, but literally a polarity of how we're going to live. Now, one of the scary things about that for me is you can say, as Jerry Brown likes to say about California, well, if they don't want to live in this way, we'll just do it on our own, which is why I brought up this sort of Cal Exit thing. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it has nothing to say about those who are left behind. The people exactly who feel most frustrated about national electoral results and who voted, I think, in uncommon numbers for Trump.
So what do you mean by nothing to say for them?
Well, making socialist paradises out of the West Coast states does nothing for people living in Youngstown, Pennsylvania. They have to feel more like those who in the Tim LaHaye novels about the rapture have been left behind. They feel like, you know, they must have committed some sin that has obscured them. But essentially, when we're talking about that sort of cultural movement, we're also saying that that's where the money is going. It means something to say that California wants to secede and that California has one of the largest economies in the world.
So I'm getting the idea that being a culture critic is, I like what you said about usable familiarity with political science, history, science. We haven't really touched on that yet. Philosophy, all these things. So I'm glad people left you alone in Illinois to pursue. You must have done an incredible amount of reading as well as an incredible amount of writing.
And it's an addiction I have.
Well, I'm glad you have it because it's really informative. So I'm thinking here about how you said you like to tell counter stories.
Right.
And
that's the thing I need to confess now, right? That what I've been talking about is not the truth. It's a story that I'm telling that I think is a useful story to tell, that I think is a helpful story to tell. It is pragmatically usable by people who want to have some clarity in thinking about what the hell am I doing? Because I think that that's what people are looking at now, the situation. They're looking at it and sort of saying, how did I get here? what am I supposed to think about this situation, and what am I supposed to do? So we're all mesmerized by the idea that we're supposed to act now. We're supposed to be part of a resistance. But there's not much effort being made to think, to slow down, to sort of ask the question of where are we, how did we get here, and what are we going to do?
I agree with you about that thinking and planning, that kind of thing. Takes time. And I think the scary thing for a lot of people who feel we have to do something now is President Trump's own words, I'm going to do it quickly. I'm going to do it quickly. I think that quickly is imposing some story very rigidly via tweets and executive orders that then people resisting this and wanting to return to something.
Oh, it's an emergency situation.
So what
There's
do we
no
do?
Question
what
about
does our culture critic tell us to do in an emergency situation?
Well, I mean, I think that we're doing mostly doing the right things, but we still haven't entirely figured out what we're doing, you know, and why we're doing it. And I think that more autonomous thought could be applied to the situation, which is what I see as my job. Now, I don't get to define things. The question is whether or not the role of someone like me, the role that I play as a writer and a critic, is wanted and useful.
And so that's going to cause me to ask you the question, your nonfiction writing is your cultural criticism. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. All your titles are very interesting and available. You can find Curtis White's books through online booksellers and local bookstores. His name is spelled with a C, Curtis, C-U-R-T-I-S, White, W-H-I-T-E. Google him and you'll find a lot of information about his books, reviews, and interviews. I'd like very much to hear about your ideas about how your fiction, influenced by John Barth, for instance, helps you with the telling of the counter stories.
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes me attractive as a writer of cultural criticism is the fact that I bring a sort of novelist temperament and also a certain style to my work. So one of the things that everybody notes about my work is that it's got a lot of humor in it. It's got a lot of sardonic touches. It's lively in a way that a lot of criticism, political criticism, isn't. And it's unpredictable. That's the thing that I think people like most about my books in particular is they don't know what's going to happen next.
That sort of matches our climate now.
Perhaps some of your listeners out there now are saying, what's he going to say next? You know, wow, this guy has a lot of strange things to say. And that's a sort of a novelist's approach to thought. You got to keep it lively.
Right. And you can't write to an ending you already know or it's not going to be lively.
True. That's very important. I mean, when I write novels, I don't know exactly how they're going to work out. It's a process of development. And I think the same thing is true of my cultural criticism. I'm in the middle of this essay that I've been reading from, and I still don't know quite how I'm going to get out of it. But intellectually, for me, as a writer, that's the fun of it. I am really going back and forth on this one between kind of the horror of what an idiotic mess I'm making of the whole thing and a sort of glee in being able to put something together that actually makes sense to me and that is new. Actually has something to contribute, because God knows we don't need more people saying more bad things about Donald Trump, et cetera. It all tends to be the same, you know, so we need some new voices in there as well.
Yeah, well, one of the things I'm taking from our conversation is the idea of the counter story, because I know very well, as you do and many people do, Donald Trump is writing his own story via his tweets, via this new idea that he's been wiretapped by the Obama administration.
Yeah.
He is building a story, factless, evidenceless at times. And what is the counter story? And I think what you're saying is the counter story has to be larger than outrage.
Yeah. It has to be, my counter story has to be larger than something directed at Trump, too. It has to be something that's directed at a far larger culture and more complex culture of interrelated but self-interested stories that were told by people who fancy themselves to centrally be our masters.
I am happy to hear that, because I think the saving grace for us is that there are so many talented people in this country, young and older, so much ability for them to get their work out there and recognized, that it seems to me like a very special time compared to other difficult times.
It does.
It's what I hold on to.
Right.
So because our time, unfortunately, is limited, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how John Barth and the other writers have remained the pillars of your work.
Barth is simply the human being that authorized me, sort of to pun there a bit, and told me that I ought to pursue a writer's life. But he also provided a wonderful model back in the late 60s and early 70s of a writer's freedom. So the kind of fiction that I write is not realist. It's not social realist. It's not domestic realist. It's not American realist. It participates in a much older tradition of storytelling that has to do with the virtues of play. And this goes back to the French writer of the late Middle Ages, François Rabelais, and his story Gargantua and Pantagruel, in which he has all kinds of crazy things going on. But the virtues of this isn't that it's experimental or difficult. The virtues of it is that it's playful and lively and interested in story. So that's what I learned from Barth. And from Spivak, she introduced me to and really made concrete, really firmed up for me an interest in a philosophy of skepticism that gave me tools for, as we used to say, interrogating the things that were told.
So it sounds to me like play was a good antidote to skepticism.
Right.
And they're balancing each other.
Well, you grow up into a world that you don't believe, which is what happened to me during the Vietnam years, right? You knew you were being lied to every day. And if you grow up into a world that you know to be a lie, what resource do you have? That's what was so tonic and health-giving for me about living in San Francisco area in the 60s was that not only did I get from Berkeley, say, the skepticism, but I got from San Francisco the liveliness and the play and the creativity and the desire to live. Because ultimately, that's what it's all about, is finding a way to life. I mean, ultimately, philosophically, I'm a Nietzschean. And Nietzsche was the great philosopher of play and art.
You are full of surprises even as we talk. And unfortunately, our time is over. I hope that we can continue this talk sometime in the future.
Absolutely.
In the studio. And you'll be further along in that essay and maybe
I'll
have
be
realized.
Around.
All right. And you may have realized what it is you're doing. Next time, I'm going to talk to you about the role of comedians in social criticism.
All right.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Curtis, and welcome to Port Townsend.
Great
so glad
to be
you're here.
Here. I love it.
Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.